quite
unusual.
Hello and welcome to the Quite Unusual podcast. I'm Nicole.
And I am Noelle.
And we are your hosts.
But I think that we should actually go by pro wrestling names.
That it would fit the episode if we did. But I don't have one. Do you have a pro wrestling name in mind?
I did have one that I thought of, but now I can't remember it because I have the memory of an 85-year-old Alzheimer's patient. But I do have at our disposal wrestlingname.com.
Is it a generator?
It's a name generator.
Okay.
Okay.
Let's put this in.
I have to put in our real name. Okay. Okay. Do you want to do first and middle or do you want to do first and last?
Let's do first and last and see, and then we'll try first and middle if it's better.
Okay. Nicole Lanius, your name. Are you ready for this?
I'm so ready for this.
Your pro wrestler name is Farmer Specter.
Farmer Specter?
You're like a ghost, but also you're a farmer.
I'm ghost farmer.
So you have a... You still have to work, toil in the fields every day.
I love planting tomatoes, but I can't touch them because I'm a ghost.
That's honestly really sad.
I know.
Yeah.
That's my personal hell.
I'm going to do one with your middle name.
See, that one's better. Farmer Specter. That's not even a good one.
Fierce Vandal.
Fierce Vandal?
Entering the ring.
All right, we're going to go with that one.
Fierce Vandal. So should I do my middle name too?
Yeah, do your middle name and then we'll do your last name.
Okay. Oh, Captain Rough Rider.
Yeah! Get out, little dummies! Fierce Vandal and Captain Rough Rider.
My signature move, I would have a lasso, and I would lasso you, and I'd pull you close, and then you'd what? What's your signature move?
I'd throw glass bottles at people.
That's just violence.
That's what I do.
I like it.
It's what I do.
All right, let me do
your last name.
Okay. Okay.
What is it?
It's just a man's name.
What is it?
Matt Frost. Is it just like a person? I don't even understand. Noelle Krupa, your professional wrestling name is now Matt Frost.
Now entering the ring, we have Matt Frost.
Hey guys, it's me, Matt Frost. I just wanted to ask if maybe you guys have seen my glasses, because honestly I'm having a lot of trouble getting out here right now and I need them to see. And last time I was fighting Captain Rough Rider, she broke them. So I'm gonna need some help right now.
Matt Frost. What's Matt Frost's special move?
He throws a textbook at you. But it's really cold.
Yeah, I picture him carrying like a briefcase.
He carries,
but he's wearing a tie that's got like icicles and snow on it.
Okay, so he's got like an igloo, like one of those igloo coolers, and it's
definitely balding.
It's for sure. Balding. He's like George Costanza hair. Yeah. He's like an '80s businessman, but like so tired, and he just has CPS reports in his igloo cooler to keep them on ice, and then he throws them at you and he calls them,
he gives you a paper cut.
Oh shit,
with his reports.
I like that one. I like, okay, I feel like Matt Frost and the Farmer Specter would be nemeses.
I feel like they would be tag team.
Oh yeah,
tag team partners.
Okay, yeah. And then Captain Rough Rider
and Fierce Vandal are definitely nemeses.
Definitely nemeses, because one is old western and the other one is like a gangster.
Yeah, like a, or like a rough and tough guy, like a hoodlum from the streets. Yeah,
yeah,
like in entering in and out of the shadows.
Okay,
vandalizing things left and right.
You're so scary.
Well, I'm fierce.
So. And a vandal. So.
And a vandal.
Yeah. I'd like to do the intro again if we can with our real names.
Hello and welcome to the Quite Unusual podcast. I am Fierce Vandal.
And sitting across from you is me, Captain Rough Rider. Yeah, motherfuckers.
Perfect.
Yay. All right, we can continue with the show now. All right, let's get to this episode where we talk about sad shit.
Yeah, this one's a really, really, really sad one, especially for those of you who like wrestling or, like me, grew up watching wrestling.
You know, I didn't even watch wrestling or grow up watching wrestling or really know anything more than, like, Macho Man Randy Savage. sell Slim Jims.
It's classic.
But it's still very, very sad. This is a, it's a little dark.
It's very dark.
We're going to try to make it a little fun. We're
going to try.
We're going to keep it light.
But when it comes down to it, it was a double murder-suicide and big hit to the WWE.
Yeah. Okay, also, I just have to preface this with saying, my knowledge of wrestling is wild. I was reading sentences out loud to Nicole, and she was like, yeah. And I was like, what the fuck does that even mean? I literally said to you earlier, I feel like I'm writing in another language right now. Yeah, that's
what
she said.
I was like, well, you know what? You're not a part of the lifestyle. I'm not anymore either. Although I do want to start watching Monday Night Raw again, because I actually really liked
it. I kind of want to get into wrestling after doing this.
You want to start watching wrestling with me?
I would literally love to. Yeah, you know Monday's my day off. Let's do it.
Let's do it. I loved wrestling. I was one of those kids who grew up with two brothers who... they loved wrestling, so then I loved wrestling, and we were like a wrestling household. We named my dog Sable after Sable.
Shit. Of wrestling fame.
Of wrestling fame.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I've gone to see Monday Night Raw live. Mm-hmm. Like, I've done it all.
Yeah. Yeah, I've done Monday Night Raw before, too.
You've done a Raw on but, you've done Monday Night Raw?
I've done Monday Night Raw, but I think I'm going to get into watching
wrestling, the wrestling you. Monday Night Raw. Correct. Yeah. Maybe Correct. We can go to a live show. They do them at the Allstate all the time.
Really?
Yeah, that's why I saw it.
Literally, can I wear something with fringe on it? I feel like that's appropriate.
Yeah.
In yellow and a cowboy hat? Or am I just copying Savage's outfit right now?
A little bit.
But in a classy way?
Yeah, let's pick our favorite wrestler and then dress as them.
Okay. Can we? Oh, I'm so excited. Okay. Okay, perfect. Well, I think let's just jump into it, okay? We got a lot to talk about.
This is a big one.
We're gonna get her done. All right. Christopher Michael Benoit was born on May 21st, 1967, which makes him a Gemini.
Mm.
Yes.
Honestly, kind of...
Tracks.
It does.
He was born in Montreal, Quebec, Canada, to parents Michael and Margaret Benoit. Chris grew up in Edmonton, Alberta, alongside his sister Lori. I also saw that he was fluent in French.
Ooh.
So,
Benoit.
Bonjour, Benoit. What's up? From a young age, Chris loved wrestling. He was absolutely obsessed with two wrestlers. This is where we start talking about, I'm so stoked.
Wrestling names?
Wrestling names are my favorite thing in the whole fucking planet. I love them so much.
Yeah.
I love them.
You mentioned a guy named Balls Mahoney, and I was like, I want that
name. I literally cannot wait to talk about Balls Mahoney later. It's the coolest wrestling name of all time.
It is.
Okay, so he loved wrestling. He was obsessed with two wrestlers in particular, Tom Billington, better known by his professional name, Dynamite Kid.
Mm-hmm.
And Bret the Hitman
Hart. Oh, love him.
Yeah. He would watch them wrestle, but it was more than just, like, entertainment to him. He was watching and he was studying what they did. Like, he would literally, like, go home later and, like, practice the moves. And Lori would be like, please stop trying to wrestle on me.
Chris, you broke my neck.
Yeah. Whoa, it's foreshadowing.
Oh, shit.
Oh, yeah. Shit.
I'm sorry. This is already getting really dark.
Okay. When he was 12, he began wrestling, like, for realsies instead of just, like, tackling the family dog and stuff.
No.
He entered into a local event ran by basically, like, a park district. And he was one of the wrestlers described as, quote, standing out from the rest.
Oh.
That's right. There were scouts in the stands, in the audience.
In this park district wrestling program?
Well, it was a small town in Canada, so yeah.
Okay. Seems kind of weird, but all right.
You know what? I'm not here to judge. It was the 70s, man.
Yeah, that's true.
It was after this event that Chris wanted desperately to start training as a real wrestler. So he began training at the Hart Family Dungeon shortly after.
Is that what they called it? The Hart Family Dungeon?
It was the dungeon.
The dungeon.
The dungeon.
The wrestling dungeon.
Yeah, I'm also going to use that like guttural tone a lot because I feel like that's how wrestlers talk.
Every wrestler has to talk like that.
Except China. Rip.
Well... she's a woman.
Rip to China.
Captain Rough Rider. No, China has also had a very deep voice, so I don't know what you're talking about.
You know what?
About.
Yeah, you're right.
She was definitely juicing.
She was wheezing the juice.
She was wheezing the steroid juice.
True. If you are unfamiliar with the Hearts, like I was before I started doing
what?
This
research. You've never heard of any of the Hearts?
Okay, so I've heard of Owen Hart.
Okay,
but
well,
only because
has.
Of what happened to Owen Hart.
Right.
Otherwise, no, I have no idea what's happening. What? Like, you are an expert.
I'm not an expert. I was a fan back, like, what, 20 years ago?
But that's when, like, we're talking about right now. So, like, that's,
oh, that's
what
okay,
matters.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
Like, current wrestling, it doesn't matter to this story.
Okay.
And I'm embarrassed by the lack of wrestling knowledge that I have. I finished my part of the script on this so late because I stayed up all night last night watching videos of people wrestle.
Like old school wrestling?
Like
or
real,
modern
like
day?
WrestleMania stuff.
Like, but like back in the day or like nowadays?
No, like back in the day. Like old.
That's
old
when it
shit.
Was rough.
It was raw.
It was Monday Night Raw.
So if you are unfamiliar with the Hearts, please do not feel discouraged. I, too. But, you know, I run a geography podcast, not a wrestling podcast.
Well, we're a wrestling podcast now. I'm going to start one.
Fuck.
Because the world needs more of those.
Can we do, like, a straight man, funny man thing where, like, I don't understand wrestling and you just, like, talk wrestling lingo with me?
Yeah, I don't think there's enough of those podcasts either.
100%. There needs to be a podcast where one person does all of the work and has all of the knowledge and the other person sits across from them and goes,
wait, what?
Oh my god, what?
Yeah, let's do it.
Crazy.
Let's
yeah.
Do it.
All right, we're doing it. So it's coming to the QU universe, name TBD, okay? All right. So basically, the Hearts are like a wrestling dynasty family.
Yeah, it's like family royalty in the wrestling world.
Like 100% right now. Stu Hart was a professional wrestler from Saskatchewan. Am I saying that right? Yes.
Yeah, it sounds right. I've heard it said that way.
Right?
I think
okay.
So.
Saskatchewan, Canada, turned promoter, coach, trainer, philanthropist, which always reminds me of that episode of It's Always Sunny where he says full-on rapist, and he's a patriarch to the Hart family. He started his training school in the basement of their 6,500-square-foot Calgary mansion. So when I heard Calgary mansion, I immediately started researching the house and kind of went on a rabbit hole, so I want to talk about it like a little tiny bit. Because it's super fun.
Well, it's the dungeon, right?
It's the dungeon.
So we have to.
Okay. So some fun info about this house is that the mansion was built in 1905 as a children's hospital.
Holy shit.
So you
know.
That's
how big it was?
Yeah.
Wow.
Crazy, right?
Yeah.
And then it was sold to Stu Hart in 1951 for $25,000, which in today money is only $250,000.
Wait, $25,000
in 1951.
Okay.
And then it recently sold. This is in the notes, but I just know this because I've just been reading.
Is it $250,000 or
$25,000? No. $25,000 in 1951. He bought this mansion, which is worth in today money $250,000.
Mm-hmm.
And then the house was sold, and I think it was 2007 for $2 million.
Well, I'm assuming they like put. They updated it.
They did not restore it at all. They wanted to tear it down, and it's recently.
So they just left it as a children's hospital? Like,
no, the Hearts.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. They turned it into a house.
Yeah,
so
the Hearts did.
That makes sense that it would be like $1 million.
Yeah, so it was $2 million when it sold, and then they wanted to tear it down. And like the current owners of it came to like some deal where they would like put up a bunch of townhouses around it and then like use it as like a rec center or something.
Oh.
It's like a historical building now.
It's a historical building.
Yeah, so if you want to go to Edmonton and check out the Hart House with me, I honestly would love to see it.
Can
Sounds
you go?
Fun.
Is it
you can
the
like
public
go
can
there.
Go there?
Mm-hmm, no one lives there.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so let's go. Okay,
let's go.
So Stu moved into the house with his wife Helen, and they raised their family of 12 children there. 12 children.
Shit.
Yeah, most notably Brett and Owen Hart of Hart Family Wrestling fame, obviously.
So only two of the 12 became wrestlers?
Like known, like well-known wrestlers.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I think the other ones like dabbled a little bit, but like, yeah, not too much. The wrestling school called The Dungeon was located in the basement of the Hart Mansion. It was described as being very stinky and musty.
Well,
this is also like a 1905 building, so like how big was a fucking basement in 1905?
Was it the whole basement of the entire mansion, though?
I actually don't know. I don't know how many square foot the basement is. I'm just picturing like it was basically like a hole in the ground that like they dug. Yeah. So it was stinky, it was musty, it was dank, it had really low ceilings and, like, terrible lighting. The floor of the space was completely lined with wrestling mats so that Stu Hart could train multiple wrestlers at once. Bret Hart described the dungeon as having holes in the walls and ceiling from human bodies being thrown into them.
That's chill.
I mean, wrestlers were gonna wrestle, right?
Wrestle's gonna wrestler.
Yeah.
Wrestler's gonna wrestle.
Yeah. He also said that most practices ended up in, like, an MMA-style brawl where, like, people would start, like, technically wrestling and then they would just full-on fist fight each other.
So it's a fight club.
Basically, but, like, sanctioned.
The Harts started a fight club.
Yeah, but you don't talk about it.
Well, it's the number one rule.
You don't talk about the dungeon. They had soap that said the dungeon on it. It was really hard to fit all those letters on a bar of soap.
I'm supposed to talk about it.
I'm so sorry. One wrestling match was even filmed and televised for a pay-per-view show between Owen Hart and Ken Shamrock, who I, in my mind, am picturing as a leprechaun.
There was actually a wrestler when I used to watch it called Sheamus.
Okay.
And he was this giant, pale-ass white guy. Yeah. Like, he didn't tan like all the other wrestlers, and he had, like, bright red
like
hair.
Like all the other boys.
And he was, yeah, his like, gimmick was he was, like, an Irish wrestler.
He was just an actual Irish human.
But he was so, just like, yeah, whose name was Sheamus.
He's like, I guess this was my thing. The dungeon first opened to train wrestlers, but it was also open to football players, various other athletes, and then just, like, strong men who just, like, wanted to pick up heavy things and put them down and then pick them up and put them down again, you know?
That's what strong men do.
That's what they do. We pick things up and we put them down.
They love to do it.
They love to do it. All of Stu Hart's sons did train in the dungeon, and later, his granddaughter, Natalia, trained and graduated from the wrestling school, too. She was the first woman to graduate from the dungeon.
From the dungeon.
Which is sort of neat, right?
It is neat.
Yeah. The nickname The Dungeon was, I'm so sorry, the nickname The Dungeon was coined by Jesse Ventura, who is WWF commentator, conspiracy theorist, turns out. And former governor of Minnesota.
I literally, when you said that earlier, I was like, what?
How do you not know that Jesse Ventura was the governor?
I don't know.
Yeah. Amazing.
It's hilarious. Actually.
He was great. He ran with the Green Party. He was fantastic. So, Stu Hart was the head trainer. And the school had a reputation for being the harshest wrestling school in the entire world. Mm. Graduating from it was considered very prestigious and basically guaranteed you a spot on national and international wrestling circuits. Stu Hart also had a reputation for being quote-unquote sadistic and torturing his students. He would wrestle them and he would force them to submit to him.
Okay.
Not 100% sure what that means, but I'm going to say it was good, clean,
like
fun at the time.
Like a tap-out type of thing, maybe?
I'm going to say yeah, like they just had to say uncle and then he was done. And then they had to call him uncle the whole time. Going it's forward, a like a weird, sensei style thing. I just made that up, but I'd like to think so.
All right.
I'd like to think that they had to call him sensei.
I would hope that they called him sensei.
Or master.
Master Hart.
Sensei Stu. Yeah, first name basis. One thing about Stu is that he never, ever charged for his lessons.
What?
He did all of this for the love of watching grown men slam their bodies into each other.
Wow.
I know.
So if you just, like, wanted to get tortured a little bit, you just, like, head over to the dungeon and be like, hey, Stu.
He had a heart of gold. Yeah. Chris Benoit would drive the 3 hours from his home in Edmonton to Calgary every day for wrestling practice.
Wow.
He was quoted in WWE Unscripted as saying, I just feel like everything wrestling needs to, like, be said in a tone like that, so I'm really sorry.
But yeah, like announcer voice or something.
Yeah. So he was quoted in WWE Unscripted as saying this of the dungeon. I can't do a Chris Benoit voice, though. Can you?
Isn't he just talk like a guy? I don't.
Does he? I'm just going to do it like wrestle voice. Okay.
Okay.
I take a lot of pride in being one of the last guys that had the hands-on training from Stu Hart when I went to the Hart family to train. It was a good experience just to be there. To imagine all the people that had been through there and all the blood, sweat, and tears that had been paid. Going to the Hart family for training was kind of like, if you're a very religious person, going to the Vatican.
Wow.
So he made the pilgrimage.
That's a great Chris Benoit voice.
I don't know what he sounds like.
I think he just sounds like a normal guy.
Yeah, he just.
But like that sound, every guy I've ever heard sounded like that.
Like a wrestling
sounds
guy.
Like that. Yeah,
right? So like a light, like.
If I closed my eyes, I would, like, picture a man speaking just now.
Thank you so much. But not like my regular voice. Like, you just imagine, like, a beautiful woman, right?
Yeah, if I'm, yes.
What are you seeing right now?
Gorgeous.
Oh, my God. Thank you. Stop. While training at the dungeon, Chris developed a very scary, high-risk style of wrestling. A favorite move of his was called the sharpshooter, trademarked by Bret Hart. It's a hold where one person is, like, laying on the ground on their stomach, and the other person is pinning them to the ground by sitting on their back and pulling their legs backwards to resemble a scorpion.
Hmm.
Why he called it the sharpshooter instead of the scorpion? I don't know.
They kind of missed that.
We're going to talk a lot about brain damage later, so maybe that's why.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. People thought that this move was just, like, dope as fuck, honestly.
It sounds dope as fuck.
Right?
Turning a human into a scorpion? Like, I'm here for it.
All of the pictures, a Google image does, all of the pictures, like, the person that's being scorpioned or sharpshooted is like, and, like, screaming their head off. But, like, it doesn't look that painful.
Well, you know that they have to play it up for the cameras, too. So they're not actually in pain.
Did you guys know that wrestling was fake? I literally just learned that.
Wrestling's not fake.
Oh, it's not.
How dare you?
Is it?
No, it's fake.
Okay.
There are some people who choose to not believe that it is just not fake.
But it's like choreographed.
It's like us. Like, I was telling you this earlier before we recorded it.
Mm-hmm.
Wrestling is a soap opera for men.
Yes.
And I love it.
It sounds amazing.
It's amazing.
Yeah. I like it. So this beautiful soap opera for men. They thought these moves were dope as fuck, dude. And this is also where Chris Benoit decided to start using his head as a blunt instrument. Mm. And he would headbutt his opponents right in the stomach.
Right.
That was, like, his thing. It was, like, using his head as a weapon. Which we'll see later. Not the best move. Not good. In 1985, Chris started his professional career as a wrestler in the Stampede Wrestling promotion. He earned the nickname Dynamite because of his incredible physical strength and explosive moves. His first match was a tag team with a wrestler called, I'm naming a lot of names because I like them so much, the Remarkable Rick Patterson.
Okay. So he used his own name but just added Remarkable.
He's Remarkable. He's Remarkable.
It's better than Matt Frost.
Matt Frost.
The Markable Matt Frost.
The Markable?
Because he's remarkable.
Oh.
Rick. But he's Markable Matt.
Yeah. Yeah, you can write on me. Kind of like a notebook that way. His first match, like I said, was a tag team. And they won.
No.
Yeah, that's right. Chris delivered the final blow. The Sunset Flip. Which I'm not going to describe because I don't understand it. This was the first time that he tried his famous headbutting move also, combined with a dive off of the ropes.
Wasn't it? I think they said in the Vice documentary that we watched that the Dynamite Kid had a similar move where it was like a diving headbutt.
Yeah.
And he, like, adopted that because that was his favorite wrestler or whatever.
Yeah. And also he was just like, I have this head and I'm going to use it.
Super not great for your spine.
It's very bad for your entire body. Yeah. Don't do that.
Mm.
Do not harm your brain.
Don't do it.
You are a brain inside of, like...
You only got one.
A human mech. Like, don't hurt your brain
is
the takeaway from this episode. So he would do this thing where he would basically climb up on the ropes and then he would jump at people with his head like a dolphin. And he said that this knocked the wind out of him and he swore that he would never do it again. But he would absolutely do this move again.
Yeah.
Over and over and over.
Okay.
In 1989, the Stampede promotion closed down and Chris Benoit started wrestling for New Japan Pro Wrestling. He spent a year there training in the New Japan Dojo. The way he paints it sort of reminds me of that scene in Kill Bill where Beatrix Kiddo is being trained by Pai Mei.
Where she's, like, eating the rice and she can't use the chopsticks.
Yeah. And she, like, uses her hands and he, like, slaps them out. And, like,
carrying the water up the steps.
Yeah, like, that's, like, what I'm picturing. Mm. Like, to, like, you're the best around. Yeah. So he had to sweep floors, he had to clean, and he had to do a lot of body weight exercises, which he wasn't used to doing. Like, he mostly just, like, wrestled people. Like, it was like as practice.
A true Mr. Miyagi moment.
100%. Like, he thought Sensei Stu was legit. This guy was even more legit. He would also have to train with younger wrestlers to work on improving himself and his body control. He then made his debut on the Japanese wrestling circuit using his real name. In 1989, he started wearing a mask, luchador style.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, which he said that he hated, like, from the beginning, absolutely hated it. But then it became a part of him, and he was the mask, and the mask was him.
Oh, shit.
And at this time, he went by my all-time favorite wrestling name I have ever in my entire life heard, the Pegasus Kid.
Amazing.
Incredible.
Amazing.
It was here that he really became like a showman. Like, he was starting to hone his theater kid skills and turned from like a meathead wrestler into just like a professional entertainer. He was an actor at this time.
That soap opera flair.
He won matches against such prestigious wrestlers as Black Tiger, Jushin Thunder Liger, and El Samurai.
I'm sorry, Jushin Thunder Liger?
Correct.
That is a... That's a choice.
It's easy to say.
Of a name.
It's easy to say.
It rolls off the tongue.
While wrestling in 1991 in a match in Mexico, he was unmasked, which is unheard of, and forced to give up the name Pegasus Kid. Instead, going by the mysterious moniker of, are you ready for this?
Mm-hmm.
Wild Pegasus.
So first he was Pegasus Kid, and now he's Wild Pegasus. Correct. And no one would ever connect that the two
no
were
one would
ever
think it was the same person.
Oh.
No one. Yeah, even though he had a tattoo of a Pegasus on his bicep.
Yeah, no, no one would catch that.
And he'd flex and be like, look at it fly. He spent the next few years in Japan until June of 1992 when he started working for the World Championship Wrestling, WCW. He had a pretty good run until his loss in January of the following year to a wrestler called Two, as in the number two, Two Cold Scorpion.
Two Cold Scorpion. Was his move the Scorpion move or
I
no?
I have no idea.
Okay.
I just like that it's the number two. And just I wish he had been like Two Cold, Two Scorpion. But it was way before the time.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. He would have been the first.
He would have. He then went back to Japan on tour, and he worked with Extreme Championship Wrestling, or ECW, which I will be saying a lot later, in between his Japanese tours. It was here that he gained the nickname the Canadian Crippler, after defeating a dude called Rocco Rock, which I think might just be his real name.
I'm going to say it's probably not. And I'm also going to say you probably just wrote all of this so you could just say all of these names as much as you could.
I'm not going to lie to you. That is 100% why I included this information.
Okay.
Most of this section is just me trying to fit things in to say wrestlers'
names. Rattling off wrestler names.
It's going to be thick with wrestler names.
Okay, cool. Mm-hmm. I'm ready for it.
Okay. And then at an event called November to Remember, which is not to be confused with the Lexus sales event, December to Remember, Chris Benoit broke the neck of his opponent, Sabu the Elephant Boy, in a freak accident. Ooh. I'm going to describe what happened as a non-wrestling fan, so please bear with me here. And Nicole, if you have any feedback as to what the fuck this means, please just chime in at any time.
I'll try. It's been a while, but I'll try.
So Chris threw Sabu the Elephant Boy with the intention that he would take a face-first pancake bump. But instead, Sabu attempted to turn mid-air, and he took a backdrop bump instead. So he did not achieve a full rotation, and he landed almost directly on his head and neck.
Oh, so he threw him in the air and he was supposed to land face down.
I think so.
Probably catching himself with his hands and slapping
him. Yeah, but he like tried to like do a sick flip move in the air.
And he hit the back of his head so he couldn't catch himself.
Yeah, he landed on like the back of his head and his neck, like completely.
Oh, okay. So he just like, it was a flip rotation that he fucked up. And instead of landing on his face where he can catch himself with his hands, he landed on his head.
Yeah.
Okay.
So he broke his neck.
Ooh.
Mm-hmm. And this is exactly why choreography is so important, especially when it's choreography between two 300-pound men with biceps the size of Dolly Parton's breasts. Okay. Sabu did recover from his injury, and he even returned to the ring about a month later, which seems so soon.
You need at least 3 months.
Get this. He was wearing his neck brace for dramatic effect, and he wrestled with a broken neck.
So his neck was still broken at
this point. It was still broken, and he was like, I'm fine to wrestle. I'm the elephant boy.
A lot of them did that.
Yeah, they for sure did. It was like a badge of honor, like, is what I was reading.
Well,
but it's like, if you got hurt, you just powered through
it. Well, it was, if you got hurt and you were out for 6 months, you weren't televised for 6 months, which everyone forgot about you, and your career was basically over.
Yeah.
So you had to stay relevant. You had to keep wrestling.
Yeah, even with a broken neck.
Mm-hmm.
A little info on Sabo. Sabo. He apparently went on to break his neck another time. Yeah, so two broken necks. He also, like, broke his jaw and lost, like, 80% of his teeth or something. He's still alive, though, and he's not paralyzed or anything.
Wow.
So, good job, Elephant Boy. Killing it.
Good job, Sabu.
Yeah, nailed it. After the breaking of Sabu's neck, Chris apparently had a mental breakdown. He was terrified that he had paralyzed someone.
Yeah.
The ECW doubled down, and they billed Chris Benoit as the Canadian Crippler Chris Benoit, citing his ability to break necks. So I'm sure that that did, like, a lot of mental damage to him.
Right.
He was already, like, terrified that he hurt someone, and they're like, this man hurts people!
Yeah. And he's the Crippler. Like, he's gonna cripple you.
Yeah, and he had to, like, act tough about it and be like, yeah, I meant to do that on purpose.
Well, and then his signature move was the crossface Crippler.
Was it?
Yeah.
Yikes.
So he carried that on with him.
It's probably good for your brain to, like, put that on you.
Yeah.
He worked for ECW until 1995 when he went back to WCW and was used as a part of a talent exchange between New Japan Wrestling and the World Championship Wrestling. In 1995, at this time, a very famous wrestler, Ric Flair.
Woo! That's what he does.
Does he? I have no idea who this guy is.
He goes, woo!
Ric Flair.
And he wears, he's very, he's all about flair.
Really?
Oh, yeah. His outfits are amazing.
Do you know his name is Richard Francis Flair.
Is it? His real name is Ric Flair?
Yeah.
Wow.
Isn't it amazing?
Well, flair is his thing. That's, like, his gimmick.
Well, I like that for him.
And then he just says woo all the time.
Woo!
Woo!
He approached Chris to become a member of the Four Horsemen alongside himself, Arn Anderson, and Brian Pillman. I don't know who these people are. So if you have any insight as to who these wrestlers are, they're just wrestlers to me. These are just boring human names.
I don't know. If those are their real human names, I don't know who they are. If you named the wrestling names, maybe I would have heard. But like I said, this was 1995, so I was 4.
Brian the Pillman.
So my older brother was probably watching this. He would know. But well, I
get him on the horn. He was brought in to add to the dynamic of the, quote, alliance to end Hulkamania, where the Four Horsemen feuded with Hulk Hogan and Macho Man Randy Savage, who are the only two wrestlers I have ever heard of before this. So this saw the Horsemen team up with the Dungeon of Doom, and it was here that Chris met his future wife, Nancy. As Nicole explained to me yesterday, wrestling is 100% a soap opera for men. And you said it earlier today.
It is.
So there's a lot of plot lines.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of drama. There's a lot of flavor. There's a lot of feuds. And the pageantry. The outfits.
The outfits.
The charisma.
Yeah.
I like it.
The acting. The extravagant acting.
It is not unlike a drag show in many ways.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. If a soap opera and a drag show had a baby with, like, a very angry baby that just wanted to fight all the time.
Uh-huh.
It would be pro wrestling.
I like that. It honestly, it seems amazing. And it's been agreed. We're going to start watching Monday Night Wrestling. Monday Night Raw.
Yeah, we're doing it.
Mm-hmm. So the alliance between the Horsemen and the Dungeon of Doom ended when the plotline of Dungeon of Doom leader Kevin Sullivan's real-life wife and valet, Nancy, would cheat on Kevin with Chris. Okay, so that was the plot line. Like, Nancy and Kevin are married, IRL.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're like, we're going to start a feud between Kevin and Chris, and we're going to pretend that Nancy is cheating on Kevin with Chris for the show.
Right.
Put a pin in that. I'm going to explain what a valet is, because I didn't know what it was until you told me and then Googled. Okay. So, see, dear listeners, once upon a time, women didn't wrestle. Mm-mm. But obviously, if you had, like, a smoking hottie with a body lady that you just needed to show off, and you happened to be a professional wrestler, your beefy, busty lady, she would dress up in, like, a complimenting costume, and she would walk out to the ring with you.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes they would, like, start shit, or, like, be used as, like, part of, like, the plotline in your story.
Oh, yeah, they would constantly be used as plotline plot lines and story or storylines or yeah. If you had a fight with somebody, mm-hmm. then like they had a fight, and sometimes the valets would fight each other. Like, oh God, but they didn't fight. They were mostly just like there for eye candy and to like support the wrestler guy.
Yeah, like that's what I read. Like they would like shout things and be like, "You're a stupid bitch," yeah. and like whatever, and like kind or, of like
pass him a chair in the ring or something. Yeah,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
yeah. So like they were there like for support, right? Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah.
like cool. managers, kind of
nailed it.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyways, going back to this pin, we can pull it out. Kevin's wife, Nancy, is known as, get this, her valet name is Woman. Why, you may be asking? Well, it's because she is a woman.
Well, first she was Fallen Angel, and then she switched to Woman.
I'm going to go over some of her cool names. Okay.
Okay.
So she was, quote unquote, cheating on Kevin with Chris. They went as far as making Chris and Nancy, like, try to sell it for real so the fans would think it was real. So they'd make them hold hands in public. They had to share hotel rooms. They made them...
Wait, they actually did?
Yeah.
Why?
I don't know. It was, like, part of, like, their thing to be like, they're gonna think it's totally
they
real.
They wanted to make it, like,
yeah, like real.
Legit.
Uh-huh. Okay. There was even, like, rumors that, like, she moved in with him and stuff like that. Like, basically to, like, rub it in Kevin's face... But this was all happening in real life. So, obviously, they're spending a ton of time together, and they fell in love, like, for real.
Yeah.
Kevin and Chris became real-life enemies because the plot line... life imitates art, is what I gotta say here.
Yeah.
Okay?
Really does.
Yeah. Chris did say once in an interview that Kevin never took things too far and he maintained professionalism, even though, like, they kind of hated each other, like, for the rest of their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And then Kevin left on-screen wrestling to focus on booking, which I still have a very loose interpretation of what that means.
So he was a booker when... So he was actually the one... It's basically like... It's like a story maker. Like, he was part of
the writer.
He's one of the writers. So he actually booked Chris Benoit to come on. So he booked this whole storyline. So there's a joke that Kevin booked his own divorce.
Damn.
Because he literally was the one who wanted Chris to come on, and he booked Chris and had this whole storyline of
yeah, probably
Nancy's
shouldn't have played that game.
I mean, maybe pick an uglier guy to have your... Because if you look at Kevin Sullivan versus Chris Benoit, yeah. and I mean, Chris Benoit wasn't like slam piece or anything.
Sure, sure.
But compared to Kevin Sullivan,
yeah,
way cuter.
Yeah. Also, maybe like don't play with fire if you don't want to get burned.
Right.
Yeah. I'd probably leave like that out of it, to be completely honest with you, if I was booking this story.
So also, there's rumors that Kevin was abusive towards Nancy.
Really?
Yeah. And at one of the... This was in the Vice... if you guys are interested in this, there's a very great Vice documentary called Dark Side of the Ring.
Oh, yeah. I don't
and
watch that.
It's a two-parter. And they explained that, I guess, Kevin and Nancy had gotten into an altercation. They reached out to him to ask what happened, and he denied all allegations. But apparently in one of the matches, Kevin and Chris were fighting each other, and Nancy would go to Chris and tell him what was happening. So he knew what was happening. And I guess in this match, Chris Benoit hit him so hard that he like bursted his eardrum or broke his eardrum or something. Because he was actually like hitting him.
Wow.
Because he was like, you
beat your wife.
Physically, yeah, you physically beat a woman.
Yeah.
So then after that, it was like over. Nancy was like, I'm with Chris now. You're like, you're out,
yeah.
Kevin Sullivan.
I've had the old bull. Now I want the young calf.
Yeah.
I'd say good for her, but this doesn't end well for her.
No.
Spoiler.
I know.
Yeah. A little bit about Nancy. She was born Nancy Elizabeth Toffoloni. Toffoloni?
That looks good. Yeah.
All right. We're going to go Toffoloni. She was born in Boston, Massachusetts, and she went by a couple stage names that were super fun. The first was Robin Green.
All right.
Yeah.
It's like a normal lady name.
I'll explain it in like one moment. She also went by Woman, Devil Woman, and as you said, Fallen Angel. She had begun modeling at the age of 20 for a magazine called Wrestling All Stars, and it was here that she met Kevin Sullivan. She was introduced first as a quote-unquote fan by the name of Robin Green.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. And she was used as an audience plant to be like, oh my God, look at that guy. Who is he? He's so handsome. This is crazy. I love wrestling.
Yeah, because no one would have said that just normally.
No, no, for sure
not. Not cute.
Yeah, so then she became the valet for Kevin, and then obviously Chris and her did the whole thing. Mm. And then suddenly in 1997, she just never showed up in wrestling ever again. And they didn't explain where she went. Like, there was no plot line for it. They just left her completely out of it, and she was never in the wrestling world again.
Weird.
Isn't that weird?
I wonder...
I could not find out why. They just, like...
Was she with Kevin at this time?
No, she was with Chris.
Oh, I think they said it in the documentary that she would like wanted to start a family.
Oh, okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay.
But I don't know why they wouldn't write her out.
They didn't write her out or anything. She just like never fucking showed up again.
She's just like, I'm done.
They're like, wait, who? Robin Green? I don't know who that is. A woman? Yeah, there's women everywhere. I don't know what you're talking about. In 1999, wrestler Owen Hart, who we talked about a little bit earlier, mm-hmm. friend of Chris Benoit, died in a very insane live televised death.
Yeah.
When his equipment that was lowering him from the ceiling malfunctioned and dropped him from several stories up. As a tribute, Chris and Bret Hart wrestled in Owen's honor, and Chris actually beat Bret Hart. And it was like the audience like applauded and like they were crying, and it was like this super like big emotional thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it really hit Chris Benoit hard that he died this way.
Yeah.
Yeah. It kind of changed him a little bit.
I think it hit a lot of wrestlers hard.
Yeah.
Because it was just a complete freak.
It was like really fucked up.
He was supposed to be suspended from the ceiling.
Yeah.
And his like safety harness malfunctioned and he fell. And it was live.
Yes, it was live. And they like didn't really like realize what was happening until he like was lowered to the ground dead.
He fell from the ceiling.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like, well, that's what I meant. Like, he, like, hit the ground and he was, like, dead. And then they were like, oh, we're going to just cut to black really quick. Like,
yeah,
and apparently this all happened because they just cheaped out on equipment.
Yeah.
Very sad. Chris Benoit's star continued to rise alongside that of one of his best friends, Eddie Guerrero. But Chris was very unhappy working for WCW, and he exited in a very messy and convoluted way. I wrote out like this whole thing and it just seemed it was just too much. But basically what you need to know is that he felt very disrespected and he thought that they were only kind of like showing the more famous wrestlers and not giving any screen time to like the lower level wrestlers.
Yeah.
So he dipped out of there. He took Eddie Guerrero with him. They both joined the WWF, which is now called WWE.
I think what it was is that they liked... like the big guys, like the 6'4" wrestlers, yeah. And they gave them more screen time. And then like the smaller wrestlers who were like short, like Eddie Guerrero was like 5'8".
Yeah.
So they didn't really give those guys the time
yeah.
that they deserved. And so they were like, we're done.
Yeah.
We're leaving here. Someone will pick us up. Like we've got the fan base.
Yeah. And then they did.
And then they did.
Good for them. In February of 2000, Nancy and Chris had a son, Daniel, and they married in November of that year. This was Chris's second marriage. He had two previous children, David and Megan, from his first wife, Martina. And this was Nancy's third marriage and first baby. Just 3 years later, following a domestic dispute in which Nancy claimed that Chris had hit her, Nancy filed a restraining order against Chris, citing that she felt, quote, intimidated by threats of violence from her husband. And then she filed for divorce. Nancy claimed that Chris would lose his temper and threaten to hit her. One time, he actually did hit her. He would break furniture. He would throw personal belongings, like little, like cute things that like she genuinely cherished. And it seemed like he did it just to kind of like spite her, to be honest.
So he was purposely choosing the things that she liked, like her favorite like vase or glass figurine.
Yeah, that's sort of what it seemed like. Mm. And she said that she was in fear for her and her son's life, which is completely understandable. 3 months later, she dropped the restraining order, and shortly after, Chris Benoit became good friends with fellow wrestler Eddie Guerrero following a match in Japan. Eddie got hit in the head so hard by Chris that he was knocked unconscious, and Chris felt super bad and was like by his side until he regained consciousness, and then they were basically best friends ever since.
So he just like hit him really hard, and then they were like, do you want to be best friends? And they're like, yeah.
Yeah.
And then they did karate in the garage.
Yeah, where they hit heads a lot, and... Yeah, it was pretty sad. In 2005, Chris's best friend, Eddie, saw an untimely death due to an enlarged heart, which I was reading is super, super common in wrestlers because they take a lot of crazy steroids.
Yeah.
And it, like, makes their heart work overtime and just gets, like, insanely, like, inflamed.
Right. And we'll, well, I don't want to spoil anything, but we'll see that come up again later.
Yeah. This completely broke Chris Benoit. Chris Jericho, who is another fellow wrestler and a friend, which, by the way, he has an amazing podcast called Life is Jericho, which I do not understand the name of.
I don't understand it either.
But it's full of, like, metal music and, like, man feelings and, like, wrestling information. And yeah. I listened to a few and I'm truly hooked and I subscribe to this man's wrestling podcast.
Yeah, he has a really good episode, which I'll reference, but he has an episode with Chavo Guerrero about this whole thing. But yeah, his podcast is actually pretty cool.
It's honestly very good. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's just a little, I guess, Chris, if you're listening,
he's we're big fans.
We're big fans of your work. So Chris Jericho said that he saw Chris Benoit at Eddie's funeral and he seemed really just like broken to his core, is the phrase that he used. Mm-hmm. He's quoted as saying that he gave Chris a hug and Chris was, quote, the most desperate, saddest, I'm hanging on for dear life hugs that you could have ever gotten. Mm. So he was just like broken inside and like totally crushed and despondent. Chris then began writing letters to Eddie in a journal just 3 days after his death, which sounds very therapeutic if you really think about it.
Like, yeah. And I think that's why he did it. It was like a way for him to like talk to Eddie, even though Eddie was no longer here.
Yeah. Family and friends of Chris said that he had fallen into a very deep depression and was often overcome by crying jags and hyperventilating sobbing. So picture like basically a 300-pound like beefcake of a man just like breaking down and how terrifying that would even seem.
Yeah. Well, they showed it in the documentary because they did like a whole Eddie Guerrero memorial episode or whatever. And they had all the wrestlers like talk about it. And when Chris Benoit's on the screen, he's just like snot and tears like pouring out of his face, just like talking about how good of friends they were and how much he's going to miss them. And it's like, ugh. Yeah.
He was like, once you knock a man unconscious, that's a bond that never ends.
Friends for life.
Eddie's nephew, Chavo, said that Chris acted as if he lost a spouse or something. It was then that something really just changed in Chris Benoit. Chris became more secluded, and his friends described him as a hermit. He would refuse to see his loved ones, but he did pour himself back into wrestling. Chris said that everything reminded him of Eddie, and he was just like crushed and broken and just so sad all of the time. His sister-in-law, Sandra Tofaloni, I'm gonna say, that's Nancy's sister, said that she had never seen him as upset as he was following Eddie's death. She described him as being so grief-stricken on a monumental level. Nancy was afraid that Chris's mind was deteriorating, his depression was deepening, and wrestling was only making it worse.
Over a three-day period starting Friday, June 22nd, 2007, and ending June 24th, 2007, Chris would do the unthinkable by murdering his wife and their seven-year-old son and then subsequently committing suicide. I'm going to go over events of the weekend from Chris Benoit's friend and fellow wrestler Chavo Guerrero. His timeline of events were actually taken from an interview that he did on Chris Jericho's Talk is Jericho podcast. And like we mentioned before, Chris Jericho is also a pro wrestler. Mm-hmm. You've probably seen him if you watched any of like the I Love the 70s, I Love the 80s on VH1. Oh, I forgot
about those shows.
He was like all over that, all over those. So he's probably one of the more recognizable, I would say, wrestlers from this era just because he's gone on and done so many things.
Oh my God, fully. And he has like the most beautiful classic like 90s early 2000s wrestler vibe. Mm-hmm. It's like gorgeous, like flowing, like definitely bleached, probably permed hair.
No, I think he's a natural blonde.
Is he?
Yeah, because he cuts his hair. I've seen him with his hair short too.
Oh really?
Yeah. And he's pretty attractive.
He is. Honestly, he's pretty attractive. I'm not going to lie to you. Honestly, like a lot of these wrestlers are like kind of babes. We won't lie. Wow. So he's just a blonde himbo at his core. I love that for him.
Yep.
I love it.
So on Saturday, June 23rd, 2007, sometime in the morning, So Nancy was thought to already be dead at this point. I'm just going to throw that out there. So Chavel called Chris to coordinate details about a house show that they were scheduled to wrestle in. So Chavel calls Chris, and there's no answer. Chris and Chavo were scheduled to wrestle that night in a house show in Beaumont, Texas. And a house show is a wrestling event that isn't televised, and it's normal for wrestling brands like Raw or SmackDown to run 4 shows a week and only televise one.
Really?
Yeah, so it's a way for the wrestlers to keep in shape and to, you know, test different matches before a televised event or like a pay-per-view event. It's also to test out audience reactions.
Okay, which makes sense because wrestling is nothing more than a play. And exactly. I guess if, like, it doesn't seem cool and, like, the audience isn't vibing with it, they probably, like, change it up a little, do, like, last-minute rewrites.
And you have to make sure your choreography is on point.
Well, of course. So. Practice makes perfect.
So Chris called Chavo back and told him he would be late for the night, for that night's house show. And Chavo said that Chris sounded really tired and groggy, and he just kind of sounded just off. So Chris had relayed that he had missed his flight and that he was going to be late.
I was reading that it was so completely out of character for Chris to ever miss a flight. Like, he would purposely, like, show up at airports early because people would recognize him. And then he'd, like, do autographs and, like, put, like, his whole, like, persona on. And, like, that was, like, his thing. Like, he never, ever, ever would miss a flight.
Well, yeah, he never – he was always on time, never missed a match, never missed anything. Yeah. We'll find out a little later. That's why people are like, what the hell's going on? Chavo said that he was concerned about Benoit's demeanor and his tone over the phone. And he, as he's telling this to Chris Jericho, he said he could just tell something was not right. So Chris tells Chavo that he missed his call because he was actually on the phone with Delta Airlines trying to reschedule his flight.
Convenient.
He tells Chavo that he's all right, he's just having a stressful day because Nancy and Daniel were sick with food poisoning. He said he would make it, and Chavo told him to call him when he landed, and, you know, he would pick him up from the airport because the two of them always traveled together. That was just like a thing that they did. One would meet at the airport, someone would get the car, wait for the other one to show up. It's completely normal for them to do that.
Correct me if I'm wrong here. You're clearly the pro wrestling expert in this relationship.
Barely, yeah. But sure, I'll try.
After Eddie's death, do you feel like they leaned a little bit on each other? Because, like, they obviously were both close to Eddie. And, like, they kind of became, like, not, like, besties in, like, the sense that, like, Chris and Eddie were. Mm-hmm. But, like, they kind of, like, were each other's, like, emotional support a little bit.
Yeah, well, I think they all... They all sort of, like, kind of grouped together. Mm-hmm. Like, so, you know how I was saying, like, Chavo and Chris would meet each other at the airport and travel together? I believe it used to be Chavo, Chris, and Eddie.
Oh, okay.
Because they were all in the same hotel the night that Eddie was found dead. And Chavo found him dead. Because they were all supposed to work out that morning. They were, because they all got to the hotel, they were all supposed to work out, and then... Eddie he didn't answer his wake-up call. And then Chavo, they asked Chavo to go in there in his room, check to see what was up. And then Chavo found him, like, face down with a toothbrush in his hand. Like,
oh, damn.
Yeah. So I think they were all just sort of tight. But they probably also leaned into each other after, just because it was like, you know, they were all super close.
Right.
So after they coordinate details, Chavo agreed to wait for Chris to get into Houston. So then they could together drive down to Beaumont. Then Chris stops. So they're having this conversation and Chris stops and he says, Chavo, I love you. Which Chavo says really wasn't off kilter because they would, you know, tell each other that they loved each other all of the time. They were besties. And Chris and Chavo were very close. And like we said before, Chris, Chavo, and Eddie were all super tight. And then obviously Eddie died of acute heart failure and he was only 38 at the time. And this was only 2 years earlier. So Eddie Guerrero's death really hit Chris, and like Noel said, he'd been struggling with the death and depression over it for a while. But Chavo said that this one time, Chris really made a point of how he said, I love you. He wasn't just like, hey, brother, I love you, you know, like normally.
It's like, no, brother, my brother, I love you.
He was like, Chavo, I love you.
I love you, Chavo.
Mm-hmm. Like, don't forget this. I love you. Yeah. And Chavo says he was just like, I love you too, bro. Like, super chill, fine and normal.
Was like, no, Chavo. Chavo, I love you.
And then they hung up the phone. So Chavo hangs up the phone and he thinks to himself, you know, that was a little strange. Like that, there was something off about that conversation, right? So he calls Chris back and Chris picks up and Chavo asks again. So he's like, are you all right? And Chris says he's fine. He just had a hard weekend and tells him he had to take Nancy and Daniel to the hospital. They have food poisoning. They're vomiting blood. So Chavo says, okay, you know, I'm here. You need anything? If you need anything, just like let me know. And they hang up again. And that was the last time that Chavo talked to Chris. Chris also apparently called referee Scott Armstrong and told him the same thing. Nancy and Daniel were sick. They were vomiting blood. He was going to be late. Gave him the whole same spiel.
Okay. Vomiting blood is very serious.
I don't.
It's not just like a thing that you do. Yeah. It's like you're like dying. So I almost feel like he was really trying to set the stage of like, oh yeah, they're dying.
They're sick. Yeah.
They're vomiting blood. But I'll be there.
Yeah.
After I'll be there. After I clean up this blood and my family has vomited up.
Blood vomit out of the way. So Chavo and Scott hook up in Texas and the plan was that they were supposed to wait for Chris to arrive. But he never does. So Chavo gives him another call and he leaves him a message, but this time Chris doesn't call him back. So Chavo and Scott go to the show without Chris and they get there and all the agents are asking, you know, where's Chris? Where's Chris? But nobody has any answers. Chavo relays that he missed his flight. So they're just like, okay, like it's Chris Benoit. Like he never misses a match. Right. He'll be here, right?
He's never not here.
Yeah. Well, he doesn't end up showing up. And then the next day, there was a pay-per-view event in Houston. So Chavo drives to Houston without still no word from Chris. At around 5:30 in the morning, Chavo that day got woken up from a text from Chris that was really weird. And it says, the dogs are in the enclosed pool area. The garage door is open. And he thinks it's weird, but he was explaining it in the Chris Jericho podcast. And he was like, it was like right around the time when text messages were just becoming a thing.
Okay.
So it was 2007. So it wasn't strange to get texts late or like half of a text sent.
Yeah.
So he didn't really think anything of it.
Back when you had to pay per text message.
Right. Like yeah. per like word or.
Yeah.
So, but then Chavo gets a text from Nancy's phone. And it says the exact same thing. The dogs are in the enclosed pool area. The garage door is open. And then he gets another text from Chris. That's just his address. Nothing else, just his address. So he's like, this is really weird, but he just writes it off. He gets up and he goes downstairs and he meets Scott Armstrong again and they get ready to leave. And Chavo asks Scott if he got any weird texts from Chris.
Yeah.
And they compare and Chris sent the same exact thing to Scott. So they called Chris because they were like, this is weird. What is he trying to say?
Right, like, why are you sending your address to everyone?
Right. So they call Chris and there's still no answer. So they leave and they go to this pay-per-view event. And Chris is still not there. He doesn't show up. Once again, people are asking for him because actually Chris was supposed to wrestle in this pay-per-view event.
Okay.
Chris was supposed to wrestle in a huge match for the ECW title against CM Punk. It was Vengeance, Night of Champions.
I don't know what any of that means, but it sounds important.
It was just a pay-per-view event and Chris was supposed to wrestle for the title and he was supposed to win.
Oh.
So it was an important match that he's missing here. Right. It's not just like he's, you know, a one-off thing. Like he was supposed to be the ECW
like the champion.
Yeah. So Chavo and Scott, they're getting asked, you know, where's Chris? You guys usually travel with him. Have you seen him? And they're just like, we don't really know where he is. And at this point, they're starting to think something is going on because it's very unlike him to just not show up and also just not tell anyone. Especially for such a huge match.
Right.
So the next day, they were in Corpus Christi for a super show. And still, there's no word from Chris, and no one knows what's going on. So finally, Chavo goes to Johnny Laurinaitis, who is the head of talent relations, and he shows him the text messages from Chris. And he says that the reason that they waited so long to like really bring it up to anyone was because they were trying to cover for Chris. They thought it was just like, you know, a family emergency I mean, others had received texts from Chris saying, my physical address is 130 Green Meadow Lane, Fayetteville, Georgia, 30215. Like, it wasn't just Chris, or it wasn't just Chavo and Scott that he sent it to. Yeah. He sent it to, like, multiple people.
Yeah, he sent it to, like, a bunch of people, and he said every time, like, my physical address. My
physical, yeah.
Because I guess he received his mail at
a P.O. box.
Yeah, exactly, a P.O. box, because he, like, was paranoid that, like, people would, like, find where he lived.
Yeah, towards the end, and mm-hmm. I think that's part of the reason why, I mean, we know that his brain was deteriorating, because he was very paranoid. He would take different routes to the gym. Like, he thought people were following him. He thought someone wanted, like, people were trying to kidnap Daniel. Yeah. He was just, like, super paranoia.
Yeah, yeah. And we'll talk about that more later. But, yeah, 100%. So he made sure to, like, double down, like, this is my physical address. Mm-hmm. And I just feel like if I got a text message like that from literally fucking anyone, I'd be like, this is really weird.
Yeah, I'd be like, yeah, I know what your address is. You're, like, my best friend.
Yeah, okay.
So anyways, Johnny gets on the phone and he contacts the Fayette County Sheriff's Department and he asks for a welfare check on the Benoit family. And this is when the bodies are discovered. So the police go in there and they notify the WWE around 4:15 and they rule the Benoit residence a major crime scene. But that's all they say. They don't say anything else, because at this point it is a crime scene. Mm-mm. So you can't really release any information.
Right.
About an hour later, a big meeting is called at the ring with all of the wrestlers, and Chavo sees Ric Flair. He's the woo!
Yeah.
So he sees him crying and he asks, what's up? And Ric Flair tells him they're gone. Chris, Nancy, and Daniel are dead. And Vince McMahon, so this is when Vince McMahon announces to everyone, stating they didn't know the circumstances, but that the Benoits are no longer with us. And at this point, no one knows anything. All they know is that the Benoits are dead, and everyone is just in complete shock.
Well, yeah, you know, an entire family.
And in a weird turn of events, the scheduled show that night was supposed to be a funeral for Vince McMahon. The week before featured Vince McMahon getting into his limo and it exploding, and that's how the whole episode ended. I remember watching this on TV, too. Yeah. Like, I remember being like, is Vince McMahon dead? And actually, fun fact, an earlier part of this whole Vince McMahon storyline involved Donald Trump.
Oh, my God, you were telling me about this.
Yeah. He and Vince had a feud and made a bet on who would win in a match between Umaga and Bobby Lashley. And then whoever lost would get their head shaved. Well, Umaga lost, and then Trump shaved Vince McMahon's head on WrestleMania 23.
Yes.
And like, that Donald Trump was featured on as a plot line in wrestling.
And that is why he will be forever the greatest president this country has ever and will ever have. Because he shaved Vince McMahon's head on WrestleMania 23.
Battle of the Billionaires. Mm-hmm. A lot of other things happened in between, but we never got to see what they had planned for Vince's funeral that night, because instead of going through with the funeral, and actually Bruce Campbell from Evil Dead supposed to make an appearance on the show.
Are you shitting me?
Yeah, but instead, they turned the show into a memorial show for Chris, because like I said, at this time, there's just no information.
I feel like that's a very bold choice. Like, you just find out that a man and his wife and child are dead.
Yeah.
And instead of waiting to see, like, what's up, you're just like, we need to tell everyone in America that he is dead.
Right. Yeah. I mean, at that point, police hadn't released any details about anything.
Yeah.
Honestly, I have to agree with you. I think they kind of jumped the gun.
They really should have sat on that for a minute.
But I think their whole thought process was, well, we have to do something. And, I mean, as we've kind of already explained, and as you'll see as we further go along, no one in their right mind would ever think that Chris Benoit would ever be capable of doing anything like this.
Oh, absolutely.
So, yeah, they should have waited, but...
Right, they never thought that this would happen.
And they wanted to do something, so I get it, but also, like, I agree with you. I think they maybe should just, like, canceled.
Yeah. Because I do understand, like, it would seem morbid to do, like, a funeral for, like, because if Campbell was involved, Bruce Campbell was involved, I almost feel like, just gonna put this out in the universe, maybe it was like a Vince McMahon's funeral thing, and then like he rises from his coffin like a zombie, because obviously like Evil Dead, right?
It's yes, there was obviously going to be some horror element. 100%.
So they were probably like, maybe we shouldn't do like this Walking Dead moment, right? Because like a real man that we love just died. But they really should have just like postponed.
They should have canceled. Well, and they canceled anyways. Yeah. They didn't, people didn't come in and watch this memorial. They like no one was allowed in. So they canceled the show to the people who had bought tickets.
Yeah.
Anyways.
So, like, just leave it.
So just, yeah, maybe but, just pause it.
Yeah.
Just put a pin in that for a little moment.
You know how they say, like, people always ask, like, if you can go back in time and like stop one event from happening, and people are like, I would kill baby Hitler.
Yeah.
Or like whatever.
Everyone, that's what everyone says.
Like, I would, first off, hot take, I would not kill baby Hitler.
Well, then what if killing baby Hitler makes a bigger and grosser person, you know?
Yeah.
It's a butterfly effect.
It 100% is. What I would do is I would go and I would talk to Vince McMahon and be like, look, maybe just put a pin in this one.
You're not gonna wanna do this.
Not tonight. Wait till tomorrow.
It's I wouldn't do anything, because if Ashton Kutcher taught us anything,
he did teach us,
it's that you should not try to go back and change history.
No, this is what I would change.
So
this is what I would change. If I could go back in time and change one major event, it would be this.
Well, this one might be okay, but
yes.
Anyways, Chavo says after he found out what happened, he just couldn't believe it. Everyone who knew Chris was in complete shock. People who knew Chris described him as level-headed. He would never start any fights.
Wow.
Chris Jericho talked of how Chris would barely show any emotions ever. Like, if Chris Benoit laughed at a joke, you knew that it had to be funny, because Chris Benoit never laughed at anything.
Damn, he was a hard laugh?
Yeah.
That's wild.
After news broke of what really happened, the WWE started backpedaling and started to disassociate themselves from Chris Benoit. And this is actually from the police report that was taken after the welfare check. So that's like the timeline of events, kind of how it happened, because obviously no one knows, because Chris murdered.
Oh, right.
And then committed suicide. So this is from the police report that was taken after the welfare check on Monday, June 25th at approximately 2:39 p.m. The police officer who was on the scene said he was unable to enter the property due to the auto gate and the fact that there were two large canines. Because remember, dogs are in the pool. The officer was able to enter the property with the assistance of a neighbor named Holly Schreiber, who was familiar with the dogs and was able to enter the property and put the dogs in a cage. And she actually watched the dogs while the Benoits were away. So she like...
Oh, so they were buddies.
She knew the house. She knew the dogs. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So Holly secured the German Shepherds and was in the house for what the officer said was quite some time. And then all of a sudden, she came running out of the house saying, Daniel is dead, Daniel is dead.
That is so scary.
So I'm not sure why they sent her in first, or if she was, I don't know, just like being nosy while she was putting the dogs away. But to me, it's sort of weird.
It does seem like that could be a possibility. Like the cops were like, okay, go in there. And then get obviously the like they shut the gate behind her or whatever, so she could secure the dogs. And then she's like, Chris?
Yeah. Nancy? Right. And she's like, really like, guys, and didn't hear anything.
Yeah.
Which is very dangerous. She should have not done that.
No, because if they're dead,
someone could have been there still.
If they're dead, someone killed them, regardless of if they're dead or not.
Right. And police also say that as soon as they entered the home, they said that there was an odor and that they immediately knew that there were dead bodies in the home.
Oh, can I talk about this for 1 second? What dead bodies smell like?
Yes. Oh, yeah, because we asked, because we were curious.
So we did ask what dead bodies smell like.
Yeah.
And we got a lot of responses from people. A lot of people said that they only saw, like, dead bodies at, like, funerals or, like, in morgues and stuff. And those apparently smell completely different because they're, like, pumped full of, like, formaldehyde and stuff like that.
Well, yeah, and I think, well, our question was, like, a what does a decomposing body smell like?
Yes. So what I have for information on this, and if any of our listeners have smelled a decomposing human body, not roadkill, because it smells completely different, I guess.
Well, yeah.
Please let us know, because we want to know, like, a firsthand account here.
Right. Because all of the time in our episodes, police officers are always like, and the smell, and the smell, and they always talk about the smell. Yeah. And we're like, what does it smell like?
Yeah, and it's one of those things where, like, I kind of want to smell it. And then at the same time, I feel like that would haunt my dreams for the rest of
yeah.
my life.
Oh, yeah.
So, like, I don't want to smell it, uh-huh. but, like, I kind of do because I want to know firsthand.
Yeah.
Because if someone described what chocolate tastes like to you, but you never had chocolate.
Yeah. Well, like, what did it? People say?
Oh, sorry.
What was the consensus?
It supposedly smells like rotting meat.
Okay, that makes sense.
It makes total sense. Yeah. But moreover than that, it smells like a sickly sweet is what people say. Ugh. So like the smell of like rotting fruit that's been like left in the sun.
Okay.
And also human feces. So you're getting
okay
rotting meat.
It's a trifecta.
Yeah, it's a triple threat right there. So rotting meat, sweet, sickly fruit,
and shit.
And human shit.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, I probably could have guessed those things.
Yeah. You know? But if you guys, anyone listening, has smelled a dead body, let us know.
Yeah.
Write to us. QuiteUnusualPod@gmail.com.
Write to us. Maybe we'll read it on our next listener list.
We might.
So based on the investigation and autopsy reports, this is what police assume happened during that weekend in June. So first, Chris murdered his wife, Nancy. Her body was found in the family room on the main floor, lying on the floor. She was bound by the wrists and the feet with duct tape. Her body was wrapped in a towel, and there was some blood that was found on the towel, but it was determined that she had ultimately died from strangulation. Her injuries suggested that Chris had pressed his knee into her back while pulling a telephone cord around her neck, strangling and eventually killing her. There was some blood found under her head, which some believe indicated there may have been a struggle, but ultimately officials stated there were no signs of immediate struggle. A toxicology report showed Nancy had some levels of alcohol in her body, but they weren't able to determine if it was before death or was just due to decomposition, because remember, this took place during 3 days, and she was killed first on Friday.
Oh, my God. Yes. So super fun about when human beings die is that you basically immediately start to decompose because our body is in a constant state of decomposition.
Yeah.
But because we're alive, we like stave it off, basically. So when you die, you like it's like we're like Pruno, basically. Like you turn into alcohol and like you start fermenting immediately.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that so wild?
I mean, it makes sense.
It totally does. I feel like my tone is a little too bubbly right now.
Isn't that so interesting?
I'm so sorry.
We turned to mush.
I'm sorry. But I do think it's genuinely interesting.
It is really interesting. And not in like a, I mean,
it's terribly sad that this woman is
It's dead. Very morbid, yeah. But yeah. It is, I agree with you. It's interesting.
Sort of like, huh.
Yeah. Never knew that.
Makes you think.
Yeah. They also found hydrocodone and alprazolam in her body. Alprazolam is a sedative used to treat anxiety, and hydrocodone is an opioid used to treat pain. Because Nancy's body was so decomposed, it was hard for them to determine exactly what the levels were, but autopsy techs came to the conclusion that these substances were found in her body in therapeutic levels, and there was no evidence that she was drugged or sedated when she was murdered.
Right, like she was just taking her regular prescriptions.
Yeah. Also, a copy of the Bible was left next to Nancy's body. A time of death for Daniel Benoit is not certain, but based on decomposition, it's believed Nancy was killed first because her body was further along than Daniel's. It's speculated, like I said, that between the murders of Nancy and Daniel, that was when Chris Benoit and Chavo Guerrero had their phone conversation.
Oh, that's dark.
Isn't that dark? So she was, yeah, already dead in between. Who knows if Daniel was dead, but
that's wild.
The assumption is that Daniel was still alive at that point.
That would also haunt me if I was Chavo.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. Poor guy. He finds his uncle dead.
Mm-hmm.
And then now this shit. I mean, wow. It's a lot. Daniel Christopher Benoit was Chris's third child and second son. As Noelle mentioned, he had two previous kids from a previous marriage, but they were not living with Chris. They were living with their mom in Canada at the time. Daniel was only 7 years old at the time he was murdered, and he was murdered by suffocation in his bedroom. Toxicology reports indicated that Daniel was sedated with Xanax and was likely unconscious when he was killed. Okay. Which kind of makes it better.
Yes. If he didn't know what was happening.
Yeah. Daniel was found in his bedroom upstairs, lying on the bed face down. A large butcher's knife was found under Daniel's bed, but it was not used in either of the murders. Daniel's body had internal injuries to the throat, but there were no obvious bruises. Because of this, there is some speculation that Chris may have used a modified version of his finishing move, the Crippler Crossface, to murder his son.
I mean, if you think about it, it's all muscle memory at that point. You know, even if he's in, like, a fugue state or, like, knows exactly what he's doing, his go-to is he knows it works.
Right.
It's fucked.
It's very fucked. It's very fucked to think about. Dave Meltzer, a wrestling writer, said there was bruising consistent with the Crippler Crossface on one arm and on Daniel's face. There were no bruises on his neck, which is why people think he might have used it. But police aren't as convinced due to the size difference between Daniel and Chris. District Attorney Scott Ballard believes a chokehold was used because there was no bruising consistent with strangulation with hands. And in order to perform the Crippler Crossface, Chris would place one of his opponent's arms between his legs and then lock his hands around his opponent's face and pull back, which would stretch his opponent's neck. But I'm thinking if Daniel was sedated and there were no marks, I mean, couldn't Chris just have smothered him with a pillow? Yeah. Because then there also wouldn't be any neck bruising.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and maybe the bruise on his face is because, like, that's where Chris was making contact with, like, the heel of his hand or something.
Right, exactly.
That I feel like that makes a lot more sense to me.
Yeah. That he, and I feel it's easier, I mean, not to say that it's easy to kill your son, but I think doing it that way would just, I don't know.
It would be easier in a way. I mean, like, physically easier and emotionally easier.
It's kind of nicer, too, you know?
It is. I mean, seven-year-olds are so small. And again, this man was, like, 6 feet tall and, like, 260 pounds. I think I saw it as big as, or, like, you know, 300 pounds, guy, whatever. Yeah. He's huge.
Well, he's a wrestler, so yeah.
He's massive.
He was on steroids. We know that.
So I feel like he could have, like, just put his palm on this child's face and suffocated him.
Yeah.
So I don't foresee him. I don't know. In my opinion, it just seems like it makes more sense for him to, like, use a pillow instead of, like, this, like, sick wrestling move.
I know.
I don't know. Either way, it's very sad.
Yeah. But like Nancy, Chris placed a Bible near the body of his son Daniel as well. Two dogs who, like I said, were German Shepherds, and several small kittens were turned over to animal control also. There were rumors swirling around that needle marks were found in Daniel's arm because it was alleged that he had a condition called Fragile X syndrome. And Fragile X syndrome is a genetic disorder which causes intellectual disabilities and physical malformations. Chris Jericho stated that from his own research, Daniel fit those symptoms to a T. He also said if he did have it and the Benoists were keeping it a secret, no one would be able to pry that out of Chris. So if they didn't want anyone to know, nobody would have known. District Attorney Ballard released a statement that they received Daniel's medical files and that there was no mention of him ever having the condition or any other type of pre-existing mental or physical disabilities. And in 2011, Chris Jericho took back that statement, saying that at the time, he was just grasping at straws. There wasn't a lot of information out there, and he said it, but he takes it back. He said at the time it made sense, but now with all of the information that they have that actually came out, it's like he didn't have it.
It does seem wild just for him to, like, make that, like, assumption, though.
Yeah. Well, there was a rumor, that there were needle marks found in Daniel's arm.
Yeah.
And you know how rumors fly.
True.
Nancy's sister, Sandra Toffoloni, also denied any and all claims that Daniel had Fragile X. And that the claims there were needle marks on Daniel's arm were just preposterous. So someone, I guess, just said that they saw them, and then that rumor was spreading, but nothing ever came out of it.
Great. What a normal and fine rumor to spread.
After Chris took the lives of his wife and son, he took his own by hanging himself on a weight machine in his home gym in the basement. Chris was found sitting in an upright position. Chris used a weight machine cord to create a noose that he tied around his neck. Chris attached the cord to the pull-down weight machine, stacking it with 240 pounds of weight, which was 6 pounds heavier than Chris was. And Chris pulled it down and just let go, and he broke his neck instantly. Chris was found hanging from a pulley.
That is, in a way, really fucking poetic. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It bothers me somehow.
It's very disturbing. Everything about this is very disturbing.
Oh, it's wildly disturbing. But, like, the thought that goes into killing yourself that way is bonkers.
Yeah. When police entered the home because of the surrounding mirrors in the home gym and the angle in which they entered, they at first thought Benoit was alive.
Oh, wow.
Because his body was sitting in an upright position, and they yelled out, you know, show me your hands. But then as they walked further in, they realized that Chris had a cord around his neck. During the initial investigation, no suicide note was found. However, a bunch of Chris's belongings were sent to his first wife, Martina, in Canada. Among his items was another Bible, and inside the Bible was a handwritten note stating, I'm preparing to leave this earth. So here's what we know. We know Friday, Chris had a barbecue with his family. There was drinking involved because they found several empty beer cans and wine bottles throughout the property. It's believed Chris killed Nancy first, most likely that Friday night. Then the next day, Chris drugged Daniel with Xanax and then murdered him. On Sunday, there were two internet searches done on the family computer by Chris. First, he looked up the story of Elijah from the Old Testament, which was the story of Elijah bringing back, resurrecting a boy from the dead. His second search was for the most painless way to break your own neck.
Wow.
Chris then made his way into his home gym with a bottle of wine, which was actually a jumbo bottle of Yellowtail red wine, which is what we determined from the police videos that we saw. So he went down to his gym with a bottle of wine and died by suicide. So Chris slept in his house for one night after killing Daniel and two nights after killing Nancy.
That's fucked.
Yeah.
I can't imagine that.
And who knows what happened if he had it. I don't think he had it planned. I think something, maybe they got into a fight.
Yeah, if they were drinking on Friday.
Yeah.
I mean, we can kind of speculate all we want, but.
Right.
That does seem likely. You know, maybe they got into a fight, they were drunk, and then an accident happened.
Yeah.
And
I think the fact that Nancy was killed first just goes to show that he didn't plan it.
I agree with you.
Because I feel like that might have been in, like, a fit of rage, and then he was like, oh shit, what did I do?
Yeah. Yeah. And I feel like, just as a generalization, with a family annihilator situation, they usually kill the children first because children, it's easier, and they just kind of get them out of the way, for lack of a better phrasing on that one.
Yeah.
So yeah, I agree with you. I definitely do.
Yeah. And that is all we have for you guys for part one, but stay tuned for part two, because we got the little explanation, maybe possible motives, and, some aftermath.
Yeah, so we're going to go into it pretty heavily next week. We'll talk about the condition of his brain, his autopsy, like what they think actually happened. And then we'll get into a little bit of a conspiracy corner and kind of talk about some really fishy things that happened with this whole murder situation.
And we do have a listener mail for you guys, but since this is a two-parter, we were going to hold this one and we'll read it at the end of our next episode, part two.
If you guys like what you hear, we just ask that you rate us on whatever platform you're using. Tell your friends about us, because that's super helpful.
Tell your friends.
And if you would like to support us with your dollar bills, you can hit us up on Patreon. We're on there. We got some cool bonus content. We got a little movie club moment.
And we have a new patron to welcome. So welcome, Peter M.
Welcome to the coven, Peter.
Welcome to the coven.
We're happy to have you here.
As always, remember to celebrate the strange.
And keep it unusual. Bye.